AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is Molly Conisby, a social historian and visiting research fellow at the Centre for Death and Society at the University of Bath. She's a bereavement counsellor and has spent the last 10 years researching the social history of death and mourning. Her book, No Ordinary Deaths, A People's History of Mortality, paints a rich picture of the lives of our forebearers, skillfully bringing the lost art of death to life. Welcome to the show, Molly.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. And it's a fascinating subject, death, isn't it? Some people really hate talking about it, and others, as soon as it's a dinner party, we all start discussing funerals. It's fascinating.
It is. Well, it's something that's inevitable for all of us, you know, death and taxes, and also something that we all experience, death of loved ones, pets, companion animals, and so on. So it's something that we all need to learn to cope with at some point in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And how long have you been researching into it? How long have you been studying it, if you like?
I've been researching it on and off, really, for the last 10 years or so. I started my research by doing sort of social history walks. So I used to take guided walks and look at different historical aspects of towns and cities. And actually, quite often, the history of dying and death would come up in these walks. And so that sort of started me thinking about how did people manage this in the past, because it was a topic that just seemed to come up quite regularly with people. Also, something I guess maybe like many of your listeners, we thought about at school when we studied history. You know, we thought about how people lived and died in the past. And I remember a history teacher actually giving us a project when I was at school, and she asked us to ask older people that we knew, grandparents or older folk that we knew, what the biggest social change in their lifetimes had been. And I had two surviving grandparents at the time, and I asked them both, and they both, without hesitation, said to me, child mortality. And I thought at the time, gosh, that's, you know, they've lived through world wars and they've both migrated countries and so on. That seemed like a sort of strange answer to me as a child. But as I've grown older, I've really reflected on that and thought, well, actually, my grandfather was one of four children, only two of whom made it to adulthood. And my grandmother was one of two children, only one of whom made it to adulthood. And I think, so within a couple of generations, you know, we've gone through experiencing this incredible level of mortality, child mortality particularly, to now, thank goodness, you know, mostly at least in kind of Western Europe and so on, experiencing relatively low levels of mortality. So that felt to me like a really big social change that kind of deserved exploring, really.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's fascinating listening to people's answers, isn't it? And I agree with you. If I'd heard that, I thought, what a strange answer. But as you say, looking into their backgrounds and their upbringings, it makes total sense. And things like that, having to cope with the loss of brothers and sisters at a very young age, I'm sure will have impacted them throughout their whole lives.
Absolutely. I think what it made me reflect on was how much, and this is probably true of many family trees. You look into your family tree and within a generation or two, you'll see these incredible levels of loss. And it made me think about how much grief and loss had shaped people's experience. And I don't mean that to sound like the book is gloom and doom at all, because it's also exploring how people coped with that, how they coped with it emotionally and spiritually, and how they supported one another. So in a way, it might sound a strange thing to say, although it's a book about dying and death, in a sense, I'm trying to explore that from quite a positive perspective, how it brought people together, how they understood mortality and their experiences, and how they shared and supported one another.
Yeah, I also find it interesting going to funerals. I don't mean like it's a hobby or anything, but when you see how different people do it, you know, I've been to some funerals that have been incredibly religious and quite dare I say, morbid and depressing and, yes, very, very kind of dark, I suppose, and been to other funerals that haven't been religious at all and have been very joyful, I guess, you know, with people singing and lots of laughter as well, a bit of comedy, you know, some funny stories and things about the person who has passed on. And, you know, people have said to me a few times over the years with various family members who have passed on, I hope you're not offended by this, but what a great day and what a lovely funeral. And that was brilliant. And, you know, people felt uncomfortable saying something so positive because people are used to them being, well, really sad experiences, and they don't always have to be.
Absolutely. And sometimes things can be two things at once, can't they? They can be sad because we miss the person that we love and that we're kind of burying that day or cremating or whatever the ritual is, but also happy because you're celebrating them and their experience of life and the wonderful impact that they had on you and the people that loved and cared about them. It's something that comes up in bereavement counselling sometimes, you know, that people that we've loved and lost are still part of the chapters of our book. You know, they carry on with us and they carry on the journey through our lives because we remember them and we remember the influence that they had on us. And I think you're quite right as well. You know, modern funerals, we're perhaps not always quite so tied to religious ritual as we might have been in the past. And so sort of anything goes now. And I've been to funerals where you're actively not allowed to wear somber colours. You know, you're encouraged to wear bright colours, to participate, to share a reading that you think might have been meaningful to the person who died and so on. So as you say, they can be quite sort of participatory and celebratory events.
Yeah, I love that. No, at my mum's funeral, mum had said many years throughout her life, I don't want anyone wearing black at my funeral. So we absolutely put that down as a rule, as much colour as possible. And some people were like, really? Are you sure? Yes, please. Absolutely. Lots of colour.
And that's lovely because presumably that reflected your mum. And that's really also lovely, I think, that she was able to have that conversation with you before she died. And she was able to say, well, this is what I'd like. This is how I'd like to imagine you all reflecting on me and celebrating me. And I think that can be a kind of wonderful thing to do. I mean, part of the purpose of the book is looking at the way we might step into acceptance of the fact that, you know, we will all come to an end and we all have different thoughts about what might happen after that in terms of afterlife. But actually, I think it can be a real act of love, like your mum gave to you, to sort of also talk about what you might like, you know, so your friends and family aren't left wondering, well, should we do this? Would they have wanted that? But she actually felt able to express that to you is rather a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's nice that we can discuss things like that while we're all able to, you know, the idea of songs and music. And I feel like in my family we've talked about that for decades. Just the idea, well, this would be a good funeral song, you know, make it lighthearted. And as I mean, I know people that are like, oh, I don't want to talk about that, and feel really uncomfortable discussing death and discussing funerals and things like that. But yeah, as you say, it is something that happens to us all. So you could say once you're dead, you have no control over your funeral. It doesn't really matter. People can do what they like. But if there are songs that you like or colours that you want or things or poems that you like or things that you'd like to happen, then why not mention it?
Absolutely. And why not make that a kind of, a sort of shared and caring experience? I have a friend who's a funeral celebrant, and she actively encourages people to reflect on what they would like and if they feel able to share it with the people that they care about. Because actually, nothing is harder for her than going into a situation where you have family and friends disagreeing and saying, oh, they would have wanted this or they would have wanted that. Actually, if you set out what you want, you kind of take that off the people who are left behind, because you have to remember this is their farewell to you as well. You know, this is actually, as you said, you're not there, so to speak. So this is about making people or giving people a space who are going to be left after you to kind of reflect in a sort of non-stressful way, to kind of think about all the things that they loved about you and enjoyed about you. Yeah. So I think it can be kind of quite, I know it sounds you know, it can sound a very, like, this is a very difficult conversation for some people, and I want to acknowledge that. But I think it's, I think it can be a really generous, caring thing to do, to think about what you would like after you are gone.
Yeah, I agree totally. And it must have been fascinating looking back through history, which you've obviously done a lot of for this book, and how different, not just generations, but different people were treated at both at the funeral, with the death, the grieving process. I mean, I'm thinking about the Victorians and Queen Victoria particularly, who wore black for decades after the death of her husband. And, you know, a lot of people saw that as being really stoic and respectful, and her, you know, showing that she still loved and missed her husband. But I think in these days, I'd like to think, hopefully, that people wouldn't do that, and people would look at that as a real shame, and it would be nice for her to smile and kind of, I mean, it's difficult to know the right words to say, because I know that the things like moving on from or getting over it aren't helpful at all, and I know that from personal experience with grieving, but nobody, yeah, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, no, I think you're making a really, really important point there, because I think grief is such a personal journey. And as you say, when we think about the sort of classic Victorian mourning, we think about Queen Victoria and her widow's weeds, you know, like Albert dies in 1861. So she spends the rest of her, you know, lengthy life in wearing black, and the little widow's cap, the little white cap that she famously wore. And I agree with you, to us these days, that kind of mourning feels very over the top, you know, very extreme. It was often much more imposed on women than men. So there was definitely a gender aspect to that kind of mourning. I think one thing I would say in its defense is that in the past, people would wear very visual signs of mourning. You know, they might wear black ribbons or a shawl or jewelry or an armband. And that did give others an indicator of where they were at in terms of grief and loss and mourning. And I think it did hold a space for grief, which perhaps we do less well now. So one of the things I've tried to do in the book is look at historical practice, but also reflect on what we might learn from it today, you know, sort of good and bad, as it were. And I think it was important that grief was fully acknowledged and people sort of sat with it. I had a friend who very sadly lost a young child, and she said to me that, you know, people would sort of cross the street to avoid speaking to her. Because they didn't know what to say. They thought they might trigger her. And we were talking about this. She's a really lovely, compassionate person, and she really did understand why people felt awkward around her. But I remember reflecting that 100 years ago plus, that simply wouldn't have happened, because so many of us would have experienced that sort of grief and loss, potentially tragically of a child as well. We would have sort of known what to say. There would have been a shared language and a shared experience, which is much harder for us to tap into now. So I think there is a case for us kind of reflecting on how we grieve now and how we support people who are grieving. And you brilliantly put it there, you know, like telling people to move on or whatever is not helpful, because we all grieve in our own way. And so sort of thinking and reflecting on how we kind of carve out a kind of loving, caring, respectful space for people to mourn and grieve in their own way, I think is also, I hope a kind of a message in the book, really.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's nice, again, just in my personal experience, of it's nicer or better if somebody says something rather than nothing. And all that needs to be is, how are you doing? How you know what I mean? How are you? I've been thinking about you. Sending love, you know, if you're sending a message.
Checking in on how people are, you know, there's that bit, isn't there, when you've lost someone and there's that sort of immediate flurry of all the kind of bureaucracy, frankly, you have to deal with around death, and then the funeral, and everybody's sort of with you, and then suddenly there you are, you know, facing this this unknown landscape of what your grief is going to be like alone. And I think you're so right. I think having people just check in with you, offer practical help sometimes, you know, just make sure that you're okay. Or if you want to speak about that person, you know, creating that space for you to do is so important.
Because for you, the person grieving, if it was somebody really close to you, life feels so weird for a while. I remember talking to various friends about this, and everybody shared the same experience after having lost a loved one. The idea that you're looking outside or you're walking along in the street and you're kind of looking at everybody going, how are they all carrying on with their lives as normal? Don't they realise what has just happened? Even though you know it's just happened to you, and all of these other people don't know anything about it. But it's weird to that kind of moment of realizing that life is just carrying on as normal, but your life, well, yeah, potentially will never be the same again. And it's that's a weird space to be in, I think, at the early stages.
I think you've put that so brilliantly. I remember shortly after my dad died, I was in London actually, and I was kind of on the tube, and I remember just sort of looking at everybody and thinking, oh, how are they all getting on with their lives in this way? You know, it felt very disordered. I felt very disordered and very disorientated, you know, almost slightly out of body, I suppose. And I think that's sort of not an uncommon thing that people share after they've been bereaved. And you're quite right, because your world has sort of tilted on its axis, hasn't it? And then everybody else is sort of carrying on, as you put it, as normal. And that can be really disorientating landscape for people to have to navigate, I think.
Yeah. And when people don't say anything because they don't know what to say and they don't want to upset you, that can feel weird. Again, sometimes you can take it personally, thinking, has everyone forgotten about them already? You know, how is no one saying, are you okay? You know, it's as if you think after the funeral, I guess, potentially everyone's kind of getting back to normal, but you don't just flick a switch and go back to normal as the grieving person. So for everybody to go back to normal with you automatically can also feel strange. You're like, hold on a sec, I want to still talk about them.
Absolutely. And I think that's where we can learn something from ritual in the past. So, for example, I mean, the book is very much about Britain. So it doesn't sort of look at international practices. But, you know, before the Reformation, people after a death in the community, you know, a month after a death would have a sort of month's mind where they would remember the person who died. And then they might sometimes have a year's mind. And in the pre-Reformation church, you know, at every mass, the names of the dead would be read out. There was a real contract between the living and the dead. So you know, that relationship was almost was actively encouraged, in fact. You know, people were actively encouraged to keep that kind of live connection, so to speak, with their kind of dead ancestors and community members. And again, I think that might be something we can explore in terms of how we support people to process their grief, not to sort of make them disappear or not talk about them, but to speak about them and to celebrate them and to remember them and to remember that, oh, you know, that, oh, they loved that cake or they adored that film. And that can, I think, be quite healing for us, you know, to kind of help us step into our own experiences of loss.
Yeah, very much so. It's fascinating, some of the things that you've found out, which are quite shocking and I guess at the same time comical, but how things were done differently in history. You talk about how not all deaths were considered equal. In the 19th century, a husband was to be mourned for 2 years, parents for 6 months, children over 10 for a year, and infants for 6 weeks. How shocking is that?
It's very, I mean, that was, there were lots of etiquette guides published in the 18th and 19th centuries. What you have to remember is that the economy was shifting and more people were kind of becoming middle class, if you like, and had access to consumer culture. And with the growth of consumer culture came lots of these kind of printed guides that told people how they were supposed to behave in certain situations. And so there were kind of, as you said, quite structured guides to how you should mourn properly. Now, what we don't know, I suppose, is how many people followed that advice, of course. You know, we don't know how much people actually internalized that and followed it. But you know, it was obviously known enough advice to make it into publication.
I mean,
does feel quite extraordinary, doesn't it?
it was clearly written by a man anyway.
Well, it was often women who were expected, and particularly sort of obviously working women had to generally get back to work, you know, after their losses. It was often aimed at middle-class women and a way of sort of policing their behaviour, you know, and sort of checking they were still behaving respectably after they'd been widowed, particularly, for example. So widows were sometimes treated, you know, with a bit of sort of like, oh my goodness, you know, they might be economically independent and they haven't got a man, you know, sort of telling them how to behave and how to respond to things. So there's quite a lot of advice dished out, I have to say, to particularly middle-class widows on how they should behave.
Yeah. And also you make a really interesting point about the stethoscope being invented in 1816, but before, and various other technology that people would use or doctors would use to determine the death of a patient. But before that, there were all kinds of things that they would do to determine the death. And it could give all different answers depending on what you were using, whether it was a mirror, a feather to the lips, a magpie landing on the roof. I mean, brilliant.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, of course, we forget, you know, before 1816, when the stethoscope was invented, as you said, and even then it wasn't widely in use until many years after that. People had to learn about the end of life by watching. They had to watch for signs. And now we know, you know, people who work in hospices and in palliative care are really expert at looking for different signs of breathing and behaviours that people display towards the end of life. And this was no less true in the past. So sometimes families would even employ someone called a watcher to sit with someone as they were dying and just sort of carefully notice those kind of really nuanced changes in how they were breathing, how they were behaving, and then to maybe gather family and friends around, you know, for the last moments. Deathbeds were very significant for our ancestors. But as you say, it meant that the point of death, the moment of death, could actually be quite a thing of debate for people. You know, when did death actually happen? Because there were certain things that you might be expected to do when people died as well. Open the windows to let the soul out is one tradition that seems to kind of cross many cultures. You know, do certain things with the body, like candles. You might want a priest and so on. So actually watching for these signs, because that period between dying and death and then death and burial was considered quite risky for the body, you know, particularly in very religious cultures. You know, the angels and the demons, if you will, might be competing for the soul. So you needed to really tend to and care for the dying and the dead until they were safely installed in their last resting place.
Gosh, it's such a fascinating subject. Thank you so much for joining us today, Molly Connisby. If listeners want to get a copy of your book, it's called No Ordinary Deaths, A People's History of Mortality. It's available on our website, tre.radio. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you.